Thanks for listening to the Something Wild podcast from New Hampshire Public Radio. We appreciate your financial support, which really does help keep this thing rolling along from week to week. If you haven't yet made a gift, you can do so online at nhpr.org for as little as $5 or $10. We'd also like to thank this week's sponsor, the Currier Museum of Art. Explore the art, science, and adventure of the Northeast's tallest peak in Mount Washington, the crown jewel of New England, now through January 16th, exclusively at the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester. More at currier.org.
I'm Chris Martin from New Hampshire Audubon, and this is Something Wild. New Hampshire's Pacmanadnock is one of the best places in the state for fall hawk watching. Many migrating raptors in northern New England and northeastern Canada follow a route that takes them over this peak. Last fall, more than 13,000 raptors were counted at the hawk watch station, and more than 10,000 of them were broadwing hawks. And this year, Eric Masterson decided he would follow them on a journey south, on a bicycle. Eric is land protection specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation in Hancock, New Hampshire, and he joins us by phone. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
This may be a cutting edge for us. I don't think we've ever done an international Something Wild. So are you still in Mexico?
I am, yeah. Still in Mexico because I took a couple of weeks to brush up on my Spanish, and so I'm nearing the end of that, and then I head south again. So
tell us about your surroundings now. Where, what the area looks like? What a broadwing hawk would see.
So I'm in a village. Actually, it's not a village. It's a quarter of a million people. San Cristobal de las Casas in Chiapas province. And right out of the gate, I would like to. This is, I guess, not really hawk related, but southern Mexico has been really safe for me. A lot of people express concern about my safety. Southern Mexico is being exceptionally safe. It's a lovely town. So right now I'm in a town of about a quarter of a million people. It's classic Mexico, red tile roof. It's cold because I'm at 7,000 feet elevation. Ooh. So it's actually quite cold, which is counterintuitive for Mexico. I came up here last week, about a week ago, and it was a really brutal day of cycling. It was climbing almost 7,000 feet, but the day started out really warm. So that's Mexico. It can be really warm and really cold. It's quite a land of contrast.
When you departed New Hampshire in early September, you were sort of in the same place as the broadwings. Everyone was migrating at about the same location, but
yeah.
It takes them about 6 weeks, I think. Am I correct to make it to South America? But you've been at this for 4 months. What have you learned about their efficiency of migration?
Well, I mean, they're incredible, and that's why I decided to do this. So you're right. It's about 6 weeks. You know, the birds that pass through New Hampshire in mid-September arrive in their wintering grounds mid-December on. And I knew from the get-go that I was not going to be able, perhaps Lance Armstrong could do that, but I could not do that. And I knew that, and that was not important. I would like to be able to do it, but I knew I couldn't. So that was not, it was not a deal breaker for me, because what I wanted to do was cycle the route. I'm working with Hawk Mountain, who have tags, who have transmitters and several birds, and I'm trying to, as safely as possible, follow the route, which, as bird speak goes, it's a pretty narrow route down the Appalachian to the Gulf Coast. And
Can you describe that route just a little in terms of what states you've gone through and how the hawks get from northern New England to the tropics?
Sure. So I started out a little bit before the hawks because I knew I needed a bit of a jump start. I probably should have started in March, but I started in early September. I think it was September 6th. And I started at Pacmanadnock and then went south through Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York. I might have these out of order, but New Jersey, New York, Maryland, Virginia.
You did go to Pennsylvania too, right?
Pennsylvania. Absolutely. Yeah, I spent a week at Hawk Mountain, Pennsylvania, and then Tennessee, Alabama. And Alabama, really, once I hit Alabama, I got out of the mountains because up till then I'd been faithfully following the Appalachians. This is essentially what the hawks do. Again, I was following the path of these hawks that were dropping points. There were five or six birds that had transmitters that were dropping points every day, and I was following those points. And so they faithfully follow a route down the Appalachians. And then once they hit Alabama, they It's really remarkable if you think about the evolution of this track, the degree to which the Appalachians line up with their northeast-southwest journey. And I really didn't have to. I could have followed roughly the same bearing. It was a southwest bearing down the Appalachians, which continues southwest to the Gulf Coast. And one of the really interesting things for me, this is not a scientific project. I'm not bringing anything new from a scientific perspective to the table. It was more of a narrative travelogue I'm trying to do. And so I didn't expect to learn a whole lot that was new. It was more experiential. But I did discover, I met a woman who put me in touch. I met a woman in Virginia, Jessie Duff McLaurin, and she put me in touch with a friend of hers who started out as a hawk watcher. And then he got interested in falconry, and then he got interested in hang gliding, and the common thread through all of this was his love of hawks. And he put me in touch with hang gliders in Texas, and he arranged for me to go hang gliding in Texas. And I, again, the desire to do that was a desire to get some sense of what it was these hawks, you know, what the experience was like. But he hang glides regularly in the fall with migrating birds. And I was surprised to learn that, A, I thought that hang gliders would send hawks scattering, you know, would basically be a deterrent that you wouldn't get anywhere close to them.
Right.
But he related to me that, no, he often gets into the midst of kettles, or sometimes gets into the midst of kettles, and they can come as close as wingtip to wingtip. To him.
Let me ask you about kettles really quick.
Sure.
So one of the things that broadwings are noted for is the fact that they migrate in large groups, and the way they travel isn't just straight line. They'll use thermals and columns of air to gain elevation, which I assume is what a hang glider might be looking for as well. Can you describe what a kettle is and how your project became known as Kettle of One?
Yeah, so broadwing, as you accurately stated, broadwings, the physics of flight are such that a hawk will spend 30 times more energy flapping south to Brazil than it will gliding. And so if you can put that in car terms, that's like driving a gas hog south versus a Prius. And broadwing hawks are the hawk world's Prius. They use 30 times less energy because they don't have to flap. And they don't have to flap because they have a series of elevators which are essentially columns of rising hot air, air that's hotter than surrounding air, which rises faster. And they find these columns, and it brings them up a free ride up to 2,000-3,000 feet. And then they glide down, find another thermal, rise up, glide down, find another thermal. And so it's basically a free ride south. And the interesting thing about Texas, and I learned this from hang gliding, is that the thermals in Texas can go to 10,000 feet or more.
Wow.
And I'd always wondered, why is it that hawks, once it seems to me, through my research, it seems to me that broadwings, once they get to the flat states, Texas, Alabama, Texas area, they speed up. And the reason I think is because the thermal activity down there is much greater, these huge thermals. And so if you're starting out from 10,000 feet,
you can glide a lot farther.
You can glide a lot farther, and actually, the world distance record for hang gliding is in Texas. It's held in Texas, 11 hours. I think they covered a single hand glider covered more than 700 miles.
Wow!
So it's just a really interesting footnote to hawk migration.
Well, one other thing about kettles and about the thermals that the broadwings use is that they aren't doing this totally solo. They seem to identify where other broadwings have found lift and gravitate to that.
Well, I guess it's if you think of a skyscraper, if you think of the Empire State Building as however many square feet that covers, perhaps that's the size of a football field. Well, not everyone travels up the Empire State Building evenly spread across that football field. They all crowd onto the elevator. And it's similar with broadwing hawks. They all crowd onto an elevator.
Do you think they, since they're visual animals, as birds of prey all are, do you think that they actually see other hawks in a thermal and fly towards it?
I do think that, yeah. I can't think of a good reason why that wouldn't be the case.
Wow, so this is a cooperative effort.
Yeah.
Unlike a kettle of one.
Unlike a kettle of one, which I'm bound to say is I think, I mean, I'm not going to say I have it easier, because broadwing hawks 100 go south and maybe 50, 60 come back north in the spring. And I told my wife that my chances of return were 100%. She sensed my safety. So I don't say I have it any more difficult than they do, but certainly the journey, they have a really, they have it honed down to a fine art, and it's really remarkable. I am in awe of bird migration generally. I really am. I think it's one of the most phenomenal natural history spectacles on the face of the planet. And there's no better way to see it than through hawk migration. And in New Hampshire, we're fortunate to have a really good place to do that in Pacmanabna.
Briefly, can you give me just one or two examples of what you have learned about the challenges that the broadwings face in their annual migration?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm writing a book on this journey. It's kind of a pilgrimage I'm on, and I wanted to honor their journey through my journey. And so, you know, right now I'm stuck I don't want to say I'm stuck. I'm very happy to be here learning Spanish. And I think there are many parallels between my journey and their journey. So I think of a broadwing hawk that may, I'm not sure, I'll have a lot of research to do when I go home, but if you think of spotted salamanders, yellow is a warning color in nature. And to my knowledge, yellow spotted salamanders are not toxic in New Hampshire. Now, if you take that broadwing hawk in New Hampshire and put him in Costa Rica and he sees a yellow spotted frog or a red frog, that could be a highly toxic species of amphibian. And so there's a language there, too. I've got to learn a language. I've actually got to learn two languages because the bird sounds down here are different also. So there are many similarities, and I'm trying to wrap that into the story that is unfolding.
How far do you plan to go on your remaining journey, and how do you see it drawing to a conclusion?
So my plan was to start out in New Hampshire and to go to the far side of the Andes in Colombia. And it has, you know, it's been a long, hard journey physically. I was sick for a week, 2 weeks learning a language, various stops along the way. And it's actually taken even longer once I've gotten south of the border. Everything, it's more mountainous down here.
Yeah.
And stuff just is slower to unfold in Central America. So I'm not going to make Colombia. So my plan now is to finish up at the Darien, which is I wanted to get to the end of the road, and there was an end of the road in Colombia, but there's another end of the road in the Darien.
That's in Panama?
That's correct.
By the time you get there, will the broadwings be thinking about coming north again?
They will. And actually, this is all about their journey. So I'm keeping an eye every day on on their location, and as I see them coming towards me, I'm going to try. It's incredibly unlikely. And these transmitters are smaller than a matchbox, so mm-hmm. It will be incredibly unlikely for me to see the birds, but I'll at least be in the area when they're heading north. And the larger picture of migration is all around me. I mean, I talked to some friends in Peterborough as they were doing their Christmas bird count, and I was reporting what I was seeing, and they were reporting what they were seeing, and I was reporting all of these birds that live in Peterborough in the summer that are gone now, and they're here 3,000 miles away while my friends in Peterborough and New Hampshire are witnessing a frozen wonderland. So it's a great story.
Are there broadwings that winter as far north as southern Mexico?
Yeah, in Chiapas there are. I've seen a few around here. It's not, when I get into Guatemala, there will be more of them, but there have been. I've seen a few, yeah.
One of the challenges, physical challenges that you faced on a daily basis is finding a place that's warm and safe for the night, which in some ways is something that each of these individual broadwings face as they migrate south. They have to find a place to roost every night where they're not going to be attacked by a predator and where they can keep warm and safe and in good condition for the next day. Have you thought about the parallels between your effort to find shelter and their effort every day?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And talking about danger, you know, nocturnal songbirds migrate, as you know, migrate during the night to avoid predators, and I migrate during the day to avoid predators. I mean, the parallels are remarkable. I'm dead serious. So in Mexico, there's basically two major cardinal rules: don't go out at night and don't drink the water. And I don't go out at night. And so people have told me, get off the road by 4, get off the road by 4. And Mexico is getting, obviously, not getting to politics, but Mexico is getting a bad rap and it's a much more nuanced country, and it's where I am now is safe, but there are parts I went through that were not safe, and get off the road by four. And that, the parallels with bird migration, I think, are pretty stark.
Right.
In terms of finding, and that you know, that feeds into finding accommodation for the night. There was a couple, there was one time, actually it was, and I'm not making this up, it was December 24th, and I couldn't find a hotel for the night, and it was actually a little bit of dodgy part of the country. So I pulled into this cafe, quote-unquote cafe. It was, you know, Mexico. You can find roadside food stops all over the place in Mexico. And I asked for some food, and I said, do you have a place to stay? I couldn't find a hotel. And they put me up in a, I won't call it a manger, but it was pretty darn close. And so I was interested to get to, I was interested to pass through Texas and Alabama because I hadn't spent much time down there, and I had no idea to the degree to which the area was forested, and if a hawk is passing through a plains state, where is it going to roost for the night? And so, you know, again, the parallels, I'm not able to find a hotel. A hawk flying through New Mexico through a desert area is not able to find a hotel. So, yeah, there's
lots of parallels. But as the sun sinks low in the west, those birds, their brains must be telling them, find a place to spend the night.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Just like my watch is telling me.
Well, we're so delighted to catch up with you, and we wish you nothing but the best on the rest of your journey.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Eric Masterson is a biologist with the Harris Center for Conservation, and he's been chasing broadwing hawks from the seat of his bicycle since September. I'm Chris Martin from New Hampshire Audubon. Andrew Perella is our producer. Something Wild is a joint production of New Hampshire Audubon, the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests, and NHPR.